to Darwin and to evolution, which also, you know, they understand uses a consensus-based approach to decision making. So the way that they have that they are attacking climate change is consistent with their concerns about evolution. So evolution and climate change seem to be inherently mixed up with each other in the church community. How would you address those situations if you were trying to specifically stay on topic about climate change, knowing that this other issue is likely to creep into a conversation?
Well, yeah, it does. It creeps in all the time. And so, for example, when we wrote our book, we put a one-page preface up front. And in that one page at the front of the book, we said right away, it doesn't matter how old you think the world is. And we said, we, the two authors, even disagree about it. But we completely agree about climate change, not because of any consensus by some United Nations body, but because we ourselves, both me and my husband, who again, my husband is not a scientist, he's a pastor and a linguist, but we ourselves have actually looked at the evidence, and the evidence is surprisingly straightforward enough that you can look at it yourself and you can make up your own mind. And so if someone is skeptical of the IPCC consensus, I say, well, you know what? That's fine. In fact, it's a good thing to be honestly skeptical. Honest skepticism is healthy. It keeps us from swallowing some things that maybe we shouldn't. But if we go to NASA's website and we can download their temperature data and put it into Excel and plot a trend line, it's pretty clear it's going up. And again, if we look in our own backyards, I mean, I'm originally from Toronto, and I know in Toronto I've seen things change over my lifetime for sure. Now I live in West Texas, and I talk to people here, and they've seen things change here where we have some red fire ants that we never used to because it used to be too cold. Kudzu is a plant that used to be all over the southeast United States, and just 2 years ago they found the first instance of kudzu over the border in Ontario because now our winters have become so much warmer that kudzu can spread all the way up to Canada. So bringing it home and showing examples of how it's warmed is important. And then people say, well, how do we know it's not, you know, it's not a natural cycle or the sun? And that's where we can again get into the type of information we talk about in our book, where I made a point of making sure that I referenced all the data sets I used. So if they really wanted to, they could go and they could get that data and they could put it into Excel. I use Excel to do all my charts specifically because most people have Excel on their computers. They can use Excel to do the plots and they can look at the data themselves and how we don't have anything that looks like a natural cycle. What's been happening over the last 100 years, and with the sun, it's been cooling. So I think that if we can get people back to facts, and if we can say, you know what, don't accept the IPCC, that's okay. Let's actually sit down and talk it through ourselves. Let's talk through the logic of this. Let's look at some of the data even together, whether it's a figure that someone else has already made or whether it's actually getting the data yourself. And on the topic of figures and data, I just wanted to introduce you to a resource that some of you might already know about. It's a resource called skepticalscience.com, and he actually even has an iPhone app too, which is very handy. It's the brainchild of this guy called John Cook, who lives in Australia, and he's actually an evangelical Christian also, and he has, all of his family thinks that climate change isn't real, all the people of his church too. So he's put together this website that collects and addresses every single question about climate change. It is amazing. What he does is he gives the question, and then he gives like a 30-second answer, and then he gives the full nine yards with like scientific references and graphs and figures and plots and data. So you can get as little or as much of it as you want, but it's a great resource for answering those questions like, you know, what about Mars, or aren't there more polar bears in Alaska than there used to be, or I heard that sea ice in the Antarctic was actually growing. You know, all those kind of little nitpicky details that we don't all keep up on from day to day. He's made it his full-time job to just collect them and summarize them.
Great. Thank you so much for that. North County, San Diego, sorry about that. I'm going to have to give you guys a shot at the next call. I apologize. We do need to move on to the next part of the call. So, Dr. Hayhoe, a couple things. One is, again, I said our two goals with this part of the call is, one is we do want to have more information, but we also want to be more thoughtful. You know, one of the most poignant examples of this, I think, is, you know, Hannah Arendt, the sociologist, when she studied the Nazi war crimes, she developed a term called the banality of evil. Mm-hmm. And how she came up with the banality of evil is when she looked over at Adolf Eichmann, she said she expected to see the face of the devil itself, but all she saw was a thoughtless human being. You know, somebody who just thought he was doing something anybody else would do. So we are working hard to not just have more information, to make sure that we're more thoughtful on this issue, and I think that you have hugely contributed to that.
Thank you so much. It was such a pleasure.
Thank you so much, and thank you for being such a delight also. Great to have a scientist that's so delightful and fun about this also. And you're more than welcome to stand for the rest of the call, but I know you're busy, so if you have to drop off, we'll understand that also.
Yes, I do have a small child running around at my feet right now. So.
Okay, well, we will reach back to our Canadian Texan again some point in the future and ask you for you to come back, okay?
Okay, and I would also say to everyone on the call that if you have any follow-up questions, feel free to send me an email. I'm the only person in the world with my name, so I'm very easy to find on the Internet, and I would be happy to communicate with you further that way.
Fabulous. Thank you so much for that also.
All right.
Okay. Great. Okay, so we're going to get to reports from the field in just one moment. Some of you may have noticed also that there is an opportunity for you to take action in a way that we haven't had much since last fall. We sent many of you a fall fundraising letter giving you the opportunity to become monthly donors, and for any of you who that would work to make any type of contribution on a regular basis, that would be fantastic. If you did not get a mailer because we don't have a street address for you, you're certainly welcome to go to the CCL website. And we're encouraging people, when they contribute, actually to contribute to the 501c3, which would make your donation tax deductible. So we would prefer that you can contribute to either the C4 or the C3. We would prefer that you contribute to the C3 that would make your tax donation, your donation tax deductible. And again, some of you either have or will receive a mailer in the next few days. If you do not, you can certainly are welcome to go to our website anytime and contribute. The good thing about getting a regular base of monthly contributors is when we go to large foundations, they want to see a broad base of support before they donate money. So it makes it much easier not only for you to be a part of CCL financially, but it also makes it easier for us to go to those foundations. So for any of you who that works, we appreciate that very much. Okay. So one of the things we are always asking people is to stretch themselves, to swing out, to see if they can push themselves further than they've gone before, and not just because it'll give our politicians more courage, but also because we can stretch to become, you know, bigger people than we've been when we started this process. So let's start in Salt Lake. Bill Barron, I think you have something to tell us about that's happening in Salt Lake City with respect to taking on bigger challenges.
Yes, I do. Mark, can you hear me?
I can.
Well, thanks, Mark, for that introduction and for the Citizens Climate Lobby. At this point, the Citizens Climate Lobby feels like a family to me. And it has been a pleasure working with all of you as we have been striving for this legislation to put a fee on carbon. What I like about it is it's a solution that's using current political and economic systems to a greater good. And I think we've made a lot of great progress. Personally, I'm driven to pursue effective climate legislation because I am committed to giving back to nature, which has given so much to me throughout my life, and to take a stand for the world we will pass on to future generations. It is with great honor for me to live and breathe for what I believe in, and so with determination and a strong sense of urgency to which we must address climate change, I've chosen to run for Senate in Utah in 2012, focused on this critical issue. My intention is to make this an opportunity to take action on behalf of the Earth with humility, morality, and integrity, and I couldn't have done it without the CCL community.
All right, Bill, it's breathtaking. You know, as Charles Dubois said, the important thing is this, to be able at any moment to sacrifice what we are for what we could become. Thank you for sticking yourself so far out there, Bill. Wow. Okay, Kathy in Sudbury, you made a little trip down to Ottawa this week. Can you tell us about that quickly?
Yes, this week I was lobbying on Parliament Hill in a senator's office, Senator Grant Mitchell, and for the benefit of my American friends, senators in Canada are appointed for life. Senator Grant Mitchell is from Edmonton, Alberta, and he was a former leader of the Liberal Party of Alberta, and Lobby as well is the co-chair of the Senate Committee on the Environment, Energy, and Natural Resources. This is a follow-up to a phone call I had with him a month ago. And I couldn't get him off the phone. It was awesome. I didn't want to get him off the phone. He's a climate ally. So I went there to strengthen a partnership with a known climate ally, and my self-awareness of my role in this very critical issue is that I am an indefatigable source of energy to create political will on the climate crisis. And although I'm about to present the information in a very linear manner, I can tell you right now, the conversation was complex, and it floated around, and it flowed so beautifully and naturally. It was awesome. Four touchstones I would like you to keep in mind are religion, national security, politics, and economics. So Senator Mitchell has been working with the United Church of Canada on a document that all Christian denominations are hopefully going to sign. And that led to a discussion about the Vatican document and that we have on our website at Citizens Climate Lobby, and I told him about it, and he said, can I have it? So I handed it over to him. So he asked for it, and I gave it to him. He was really pleased with that work. And then that led to me discussing how every month we have such incredible education through Citizens Climate Lobby, and that gets me over to the military file, and also that we at the national conference had great people. So I talked about Nickleby and Porter's national strategic narrative to the Joint Chiefs of Staff and quickly went over it about how, you know, we're going from a closed to an open system way of thinking, and he loved that. He went off on a beautiful tangent on that. We discussed it, and then he asked, and then I had it in front of me. He goes, oh, can I have that one too? So I ended up giving him the national strategic narrative for national security for the United States, and it was an awesome conversation. And with regards to politics, three times he kept saying to me, how are we going to get the people to do this? And I finally just said, Senator Mitchell, it's not you that's going to get people to do this. It's the citizens. It's the citizens that will create the political will. And we discussed the economics of it. And in the current political environment in Canada, the Conservatives are in power. And just last week, John Baird said he will not put a price on carbon. And so we discussed that a bit further. And Senator Mitchell's from Edmonton. And his beautiful offer to us is he will help us find somebody in Edmonton to start up a chapter there. He knows a few people who are really concerned about climate change. And for any of you naysayers who don't think there are people who are in Alberta concerned about climate change, one of our volunteers here is from Alberta, and Alberta is a very progressive province. I left that meeting feeling like I had taken the best roller coaster ride in the world. I felt like a little kid. It was so awesome. I thank you all so much for supporting and just being there and teaching me and being, as Bill said, family. Thank you, everyone.
Great, Bill. I mean, Kathy, awesome. Also, you know, what we are always looking for is that kind of partnership with politicians. When they're saying they're going to help us find people to start groups, we're developing the kind of relationship, the kind of partnership that we're looking for. Fabulous work in both of your cases. And John Howard, Minneapolis, we're looking forward to making some official announcement about you shortly. All right. Amy Bennett, I'm assuming we did more than just two things this month. Is that correct?
Yes, Mark. Can you hear me?
I can.
Okay, great. Yes, as far as reports from the field, one of the things we did last month is we sent out press releases. Everyone in CCL sent out press releases, and I'd like to read just a few sentences from one. Preciamos colocar un preso no monóxido carbón, dice director executivo Mark Reynolds.
Whoa!
Okay, so I'm guessing, given the only one something that we got published in a foreign language was Toronto got something published by a Brazilian news organization, so I'm assuming that that's Portuguese?
That is correct, Mark.
All right, very nice. Keep going.
Okay. Reports from the field. Let me just explain that when I refer to an LTE, that's a letter to the editor. Coronado had a person-to-person phone conversation with Representative Brian Bilbray, 5 million letter march letters, and Marshall gave a million letter march talk. Also, 4 letters to the editor, including the LA Times, the Washington Post, the Boston Globe and the Union Tribune in San Diego. We also had Mark quoted in The Hill and a radio interview. In Anchorage, Alaska, two letters to the editor, 20 million letter march letters, and tabling at a Bioneers conference. In North San Diego, one LTE. In South San Diego, one LTE. In San Francisco, participation in the Keystone XL pipeline demonstration. In Marin, a meeting with a candidate running for Representative Woolsey's seat, Mr. Huffman. In Atlanta, LTE. In USA Today, two op-eds in the Huffington Post, a radio interview with Steve, and a protest outside the CNN offices on the tar sands, and a meeting with Mr. McDonald of Georgia Pacific Utility discussing fee and dividend. In Boston, Massachusetts, one LTE, and D.R. Tucker wrote on David Frum's From Forum blog. Minneapolis, participation in the Power Shift Conference. In Alexandria, Minnesota, we had three ed board meetings at local papers, four LTEs, one op-ed. In Bemidji, we had a group start. In Red Bank, New Jersey, we had a webcast on building the green economy. We also had a separate presentation on building the green economy with 40 people present. We had 54 million letter march letters in Princeton, New Jersey, and two speaking engagements. Also, a showing of Carbon Nation and an editorial board meeting at the Trenton Times. Norman, Oklahoma, meeting with Representative Tom Cole's staff about the pipeline, three letters to the editor, one article, 19 million letter march letters at a farmer's market. We had two CCL members speaking at a Keystone Pipeline hearing in Midwest City, Oklahoma, and a CCL volunteer spoke at a Methodist church regarding Mark Jacobson's work. We have in York, Pennsylvania, participation in an outreach event about fracking. In Salt Lake City, Utah, two LTEs, one article, 1 million letter march letter, and participation at the Bioneers Conference, a table, and an educational event hosted by Bill on creating political will with your pen. In Richmond, Virginia, we had four LTEs, one article. In Seattle, Washington, one LTE. In Madison, Wisconsin, editorial in the Capital Times about the Save Our Climate Act. We had one meeting with Madison Gas and Electric legislative director discussing the fee and dividend, and one fundraiser where CCL was a beneficiary at a slow food event. In Toronto, Canada, two LTEs, tabling at Ward 32's Green Home Fair, and the press release, the two press releases came out, and then two LTEs in Sudbury, three articles, three arrests in Sudbury, and an article on the blog Media Co-op. And let's see, Kathy already mentioned the meeting with Senator Mitchell. And then in Red Lake, we had two LTEs. And lastly, I want to thank everyone. We had 26 people on the introductory call over the last two Wednesday night calls.
Great. And a lot of those people are already in the process of starting their group. So really nice report, Amy, and really nice work, everybody. So, Amy, why don't you stay on, because I know you and Marshall are going to train us on this month's Laser Talk in just a moment. Let me just say one thing, though, because I know a lot of people who are on the call and some people who had to miss the call are going to be in Washington, D.C. for the Hands Around the White House Keystone Pipeline protest tomorrow. And we're, all of us who are not able to be there are so grateful for all of those of you who are going. Particularly, I want to also mention Paul Thompson, who's not only going to that, but is meeting with people at the State Department who are pretty far up that give us a chance of getting a message to Secretary Clinton. So thank you all for doing that. I know that for 3 years we have been focusing on the big picture, the getting a price on carbon, but this is something in the interim that it looks like we have a chance of success with, and we're all so grateful to all the work that everybody at 350 and Bill McKibben is doing on this, and for all of you who are going to be there tomorrow, thank you so much. We're all the rest of us are extremely grateful that you'll be there. Okay, Marshall and Amy, are you prepared to teach us this month's Laser Talk?
Mark, can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
Okay, great. Well, yeah, thank you very much. And good morning, everybody, and good afternoon, everybody. Like Dr. Hayhoe, I've been going to church my whole life, and one of the things we do every Sunday is responsive reading, so I thought we'd try it on the Laser Talk. It's just very simple. We just read alternating sentences on the Laser Talk. So if you have the Laser Talk, you might pull it out and look at it and go along with Amy and me. So, Amy, are you ready to go?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me, Marshall?
I can hear you. Okay. Now there are now 7 billion people on planet Earth, and we continue to add more than 1 million each week.
Most of these people have low carbon footprints, but they aspire to live a more comfortable life like we do in North America.
To meet electricity demands in the year 2030 will require 13,000 additional coal-fired power plants.
Given the threat that climate change poses to the Earth and its people, this is an unacceptable scenario.
There is an alternative.
Two leading researchers have drafted a plan whereby all the world's energy needs can be met with carbon-free sources by the year 2030.
And that's using technology that already exists.
We only need 11.5 terawatts of electricity, a small fraction of the total amount of wind, water, and solar energy that's available on the surface of the Earth.
Using the right mix of energy, we can maintain a steady supply of power even when the wind is not blowing and the sun is not shining.
We can do this using less than 1.5% of the land.
Building out the necessary infrastructure to accomplish this will be a massive undertaking.
The quickest and most effective way to facilitate this buildup is with an economic incentive.
So we need to put a price on
carbon
that guarantees wind and solar will be more profitable than coal and oil.
Representative Pete Stark has introduced legislation that provides that incentive with the Save Our Climate Act, which taxes carbon-based fuels.
This bill would return most of the revenue from the tax to individuals as annual payments, protecting households against rising energy costs.
Congressman, will you co-sponsor the Save Our Climate Act?
Okay, great. That's the Laser Talk. And Amy, thank you very much. When we hang up the phone, everybody, please pair up and read the Laser Talk responsively like Amy and I did. Then read it again, but exchange parts. Then lay it down, and see how much of it you can say just talking. Have fun with it and be expressive. You can be outrageous, but of course not in church. Okay, Mark, back to you.
All right, you caught me off guard with that last comment, Marshall. Good one. Okay, so there's three actions we're asking everybody to take this month. One is practice the Laser Talk, and please do it exactly the way Marshall just requested. It's just the easiest way to get it ingrained. Then we're asking everybody to write a letter, a handwritten personal letter, either to your member of Parliament or Congress, asking they either introduce introduced in the case of Canada, or co-sponsor in the case of U.S., Representative Stark's Act, H.R. 3242, the Save Our Climate Act. If you Canadians, you want to ask your members to duplicate what happens in B.C., that's fine, but we want something where a price is put on carbon and the money goes back to American households, U.S. and Canadian households. So please designate one person in the group then to follow up with the key legislative aid and ask them to actually have that person please call and ask them to co-sponsor the legislation or introduce the legislation. Then the second piece, third action, the second piece in addition to practicing the talk, is to build on what Dr. Hayhoe was talking about today. And that is We're asking that every single group has someone step forward and reach out to a faith-based organization in your community and ask if we can make a presentation. Now, we've got a lot of really good presentations that people have been out there doing, and I think the model that we should all be working from is the program that Joe Robertson put together on building a green economy. But what we're going to now do is take the comments and the things from Dr. Hayhoe's book, and we're going to add some slides with respect to the faith-based introduction, context, etc. So we'll be getting that out to people. We'll be offering up training sessions if you want some training before making that presentation. But we would like every single group to reach out to some faith-based organization and make a presentation in your community to start building community by community by community support. So, great work for everybody again last month. Thank you for all you're doing. Go ye forth and make great things happen again in the month of November. We'll talk to all the first Saturday in December. Have a great month, everybody. Thank you so much.
Danny LaHoya.
Hey, Danny LaHoya. How are you today?
Ann from Seattle.
Hey, Ann. Good morning.
Morning.
Who else has joined the call?
You're in Marin.
Hey, Peter. Are you in Marin or are you in D.C.?
I'm in Marin now. I'm going to D.C. tonight. And I have six people here in the room with me.
All right. Fabulous. Who else has joined the call?
Madeline and Madison with Benson.
Hey, Madeline and Madison. Good morning. Good noonish, I guess.
Yeah, whatever.
Well, who else just joined?
It's Mike Arney in Wauwatosa, Wisconsin.
Great. Welcome. Great to have you.
And John in San Jose.
Hi, John, San Jose. How are you this morning?
Just fine.
Hey, I am. Good morning. Who just joined?
This is Ross from Kenosha.
Hey, good morning. I'm good noonish. Excuse me. All right, I'm going to mute everybody but our speaker, so hold on, everybody, for 1 second here.
All guests have been muted. You can unmute your line by pressing star 6.
Okay, Dr. Hayhoe?
Yes, I'm here. Hello?
Okay, good. I just want to make sure that I always like to do a little test here to make sure that everybody else's line is muted, but I can hear yours.
Yes, I am here.
Okay, good. All right, well, welcome, everybody. This is the November Citizens Climate Lobby International Call. Our guest speaker today is Dr. Catherine Hayhoe, an atmospheric scientist and also the co-author of A Climate for Change, Global Warming Facts for Faith-Based Decisions. So we'll invite Dr. Hayhoe to start making her comments in just a moment. Just so you know, Dr. Hayhoe, there's three things we do every month on this call. One is the first part is educational, which I'll come to in a second. And then we do two other things every single month. Every month we practice communicating about the issue of climate change because we take the view that ultimately it doesn't matter what we say, it matters what people hear. So we go to work on ourselves every month trying to get better at communicating about the issue. And then every month we take an assessment of what got done since the previous month, what kind of action got generated, and then what are we promising to do? So you're welcome to stay on for the second half of the call, but certainly I know you're busy. I know you have a family. So if you're just on for the educational portion, that would be fantastic. But if you want to stay on for the second half, that would be great.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. So there's two things that we try to accomplish in the educational portion. One is we are always looking to add additional information. So we've had scientists, we've had economists, we've had politicians, we've had legislative experts, so that we're looking to have more knowledge at the end of every call. But we also know that just having information is not enough. You know, you take everybody already knows what they should be doing about diet and exercise, but that doesn't mean they necessarily do. So in addition to having more information, we're also looking to be more thoughtful on the issue. William James said, a great many people think they are thinking when they are merely rearranging their prejudices. So we're not looking to just have information, but also be more thoughtful on the issue every month. And that's partially why we're so excited. I think that you bring a piece to this that we have not had a chance to really get our hands around in the 3 years we've been doing this. So first of all, here you are, a hardcore scientist, and we know scientists like to do science, and then you went from just doing science to also then writing a book and working to speak out on this issue, and particularly in the area of how people could reach conservative or faith-based audiences. So would you mind start by just saying a little bit about how did that transition happen, and tell us what brought you to read the book and what you, write it, and what you were trying to accomplish with that?
Sure. I actually grew up in South America as a missionary kid. And so faith has always been part of my life, as, you know, as long as I've been alive. But interestingly, it was when I first moved to Texas that my faith and climate really started to come together, because moving here was a little bit kind of like one of those missionaries going to darkest Africa in the 1800s. You didn't know for sure if you're going to be stuck into the stew pot and boiled for your views that the natives didn't agree with. And so I definitely felt that way about climate. Because you know the people in West Texas especially are not really on board with the idea of global climate change. But what I realized, though, is that people here are very curious, and they have a lot of good questions. And a lot of those questions relate to our faith. Like, if we believe that God is in charge, how could something like this happen? Or if we believe that God created the earth, didn't he put people in charge of it, and shouldn't we be able to do whatever we want? That actually is a sincere question that people have. So these are the types of questions we're getting, and I realized that our values are so important to the things that we do that we have to be able to tie our values into this issue. And if we don't, we're never going to be able to address it.
Great. And tell us a little bit about some of the things that you cover in the book.
The book is based on all of the questions that I've gotten and that my husband has gotten over the past 5 or 6 years. My husband is a linguistics professor, but he's also the pastor of a local church. And so he even gets more questions than I do, I think, probably because people are a little bit nervous of asking the scientist. And so we get questions like, it's freezing outside. Where's global warming now? Or how do we know this isn't a natural cycle or the sun? Or again, if you believe God is in control, then how could something like this happen, and why should we even worry about it? Won't it all work out? So the book is all about trying to answer these common questions that people have using very basic facts and analogies that we can all understand.
Well, there's one of those in particular that I'd like you to expand on a little bit, because we ask all of our groups to take action every month, and lots of times it's about meeting with members of Parliament or Congress or writing their paper. But one of the specific actions we're doing this month is asking every group to reach out to some faith-based community in their that's local for them and offer to do a talk on the issue of climate change. Now, most of our people are pretty solid on the science. Most people understand the policy pretty well. One of the things that we want to develop from your talk is, you know, some of the context for the introducing this in a faith-based environment. So I'm really interested in, how do you answer the question when someone says, okay, God's in charge, why do we need to even worry about it? How do you deal with that?
Well, that isn't as hard a question to address as you'd think, because we can say, we can certainly believe that God is in charge, but look around the world. What happens in the world? Do we have crime? Do we have natural disasters? Do we have bad things happening to good people? Of course we do. And many of these things are happening because we make poor decisions. We have free will. And we reap the consequences of our actions. There's many verses in the Bible that we can even point out talking about how you reap what you sow. And if we make poor lifestyle choices, for example, God doesn't preserve us from heart disease. So in that same way, if we make poor lifestyle choices as a society, there's no reason why God would have to preserve us from the consequences of those actions from climate change.
Great. And did you kind of discover this, but were you good all along, or were you more like we were, where a lot of what we learned worked was because of the things we said that just annoyed people?
This is very, very much, you know, trial and error for sure. What I've learned over the years, and I talk to all kinds of, you know, I talk to senior citizens and church groups and grade school kids and water managers and Kiwanis clubs and clubs. And, you know, so I talked to all kinds of people, and I've certainly put my foot in things, as I'm sure everybody else has. But what I've learned is that there's a couple of important things that we do want to say when talking to faith-based communities, and there's a couple of very important things that we do not want to say when we're talking to faith-based communities. Which ones do you want to start with?
Let's start with what we don't, and then let's get to what we do.
Okay. Sometimes what we don't is more interesting. One of the biggest issues, especially here in the United States, not so much in Canada, is the issue of the age of the Earth and the creation-evolution debate. The trenches run so deep on this issue that if you even mention anything to one side or the other, that could just be the end. That could be the end of any ability you had to reach people. And so I make it a point to say that agreeing that climate change is happening has nothing to do with the age of the Earth. And I would even go so far as to say we have all the time in the world to talk about that discussion in terms of how it impacts our daily lives. We do not have all the time in the world to talk about the issue of climate change. And so far, you know, rather than trying to convince everybody of my point of view on every issue related to science of faith, I think we just need to major on the majors, and the major is climate change. And so, for example, what we did in our book was we created a graph that I'd never seen before in my entire life, and that graph was looking at our temperature and our carbon dioxide levels for the past 6,000 years. 6,000 years. And that's a really important graph because that is how old, I think, the statistics are something like 47% of Americans think that the world is. And so showing a graph that, you know, like Al Gore shows a graph that goes back, you know, 400,000 years, well, immediately by showing that graph, you've lost half your audience. You've lost your credibility. They no longer even want to talk with you. And that's the second thing I would recommend not bringing up is Al Gore. if you're in a conservative audience, there have been polls showing that of all the things or people or events or information you could say or not say, Al Gore is one of the most polarizing. Especially speaking to conservative faith-based audiences, if in any way you mention his name or seem affiliated with him in any way or even agree with him, then that just turns them off because there is this, and you know, I don't fully understand it, but there is this deep-rooted hatred of his name, which is terrible. I mean, I feel it's very terrible, but it's a reality that we need to be aware of. So the creation evolution issue and Al Gore's name are the two things that I would say stay away from and do not touch with a 10-foot pole, especially when you're talking to conservative communities.
Yeah, I think that's so important because one of the things we're constantly working with ourselves is what's the more important thing to accomplish, to prove to them that they're wrong and we're right, or to actually get something done and find common ground. And, you know, it's hard to, when you think people are off base on things, to not feel like you have to kind of rub it in their face. But if you want to get things done, you have to take a different view. So I really appreciate that comment. Now, what about the things that we should pay attention to? What are the things that we should say?
That's where we need to start with our common values. We need to identify the things that we have in common. So, for example, coming in, well, I'm a scientist, so coming in as a scientist, people already think I'm sort of an alien species. So, bridging common ground, talking about my own faith and the things that I feel important, talking about how I feel that that God created the universe and that he gave us this amazing planet and that we are stewards of this planet. Focusing on our common values, first of all, and the things that we all believe. The interesting thing is that if you look at the theology that we have to believe to agree on climate change, it's surprisingly little. The only aspects of theology that we really have to agree on are, first of all, that God was involved in some way, shape, or form in creating the universe and the earth, however that you may believe that happened. And second of all, that he gave people a responsibility to care for it.
And then third of all, that Jesus, under the new covenant, gave us a great commandment to love our God and to love our neighbor as ourselves. And today, our neighbors, and especially the poor and the disadvantaged, the very people who the church is supposed to care for, those are the people who are being harmed by the effects of climate change. Those are the people who we are told to love and to care for. So these are the only theological areas that we need to agree on in order to agree that climate change is an issue that the church should be doing something about.
Great. Great, great, great. Now, I'm going to just change directions with you for just a second, if that's okay.
Yeah, sure.
Okay, one of the things that I have enjoyed about reading what you've written, I haven't read the whole book, but I've read some excerpts, is me with my extensive scientific background, that is, I passed high school biology. I am able to understand the things that you, when you go to explain scientific issues. So I'm always interested, particularly from scientists, when you go to explain climate change and you've got 2 minutes, how do you do it? Because I find it easy to assimilate the things that you've written. So I'm interested in really in communication with respect to this issue. So when you go and you just have a couple of minutes, how do you communicate this issue to people?
That's a good question. Kind of the elevator speech. If we just have the 30 seconds before the door opens, what do we say?
Right.
I think it's important to do two things if you in that 30 minutes or 2 minutes that you have. I think, first of all, we have to explain that what is going on right now is that the planet is warming. It's not just about thermometers and satellites. It's about birds and insects and plants and trees. The evidence for warming is right in our own backyards. Number two, this warming doesn't look like any natural cycle we've seen before. And if this warming were occurring because of the sun, we would actually be getting cooler the last 40 years, not warmer. So that's the second point, is to highlight right away that it doesn't look like a natural cycle, and we would be getting cooler if it was for the sun. In fact, we were in a solar minimum in 2009, 2010, like we haven't seen since the Little Ice Age in the 1700s. Point number three is that ever since the Industrial Revolution, we've been producing increasing amounts of these heat-trapping gases every time we burn coal or gas or oil. You can measure them coming out of the smokestack of any factory or the tailpipe of your car. And these gases are building up in the atmosphere doing exactly what their name suggests, trapping heat. So it makes all the sense in the world that when we look at a warming planet and we realize that it should be cooling, that the only thing that could possibly be causing that warming are those heat-trapping gases.
Great. Okay. Well, in just a moment, I'm gonna open it up to some of our groups. So let me just alert the groups who I'll call on first. And if you have a question, great. If you don't, we'll just go to the next city. So we'll start in Richmond, and then La Jolla, and then Bemidji, and then St. Petersburg. So if we have more cities after that, we'll give other people chances. So when it's your turn, if you star six your phone, it'll unmute you and you can ask the question. Let me ask you one thing so that they can think about what they'd like to ask. So yesterday, the IPCC released their preliminary draft of their report tying extreme weather-related events to climate change. I was wondering if you had a chance to look at that yet and if you could comment on it.
Yes. The IPCC reports are a great summary of what's already been out there in the scientific literature for a couple of years. And so this report is a summary of a lot of different papers I've read already. But the reason why it's so good to have a report like this is because it pulls it all together and it gives us the big picture. So you have one study looking at changes in climate extremes in the Northeast U.S., and then you have another one looking at the heat wave in Russia in 2010, and then you have another paper looking at, you know, flooding in Pakistan last year. And it's not until we really put all these together that we can look at the big picture of what's happening to the planet. Because isolated events in one place, like the massive drought that we have in Texas this year, or the other events that we've seen around the world, one event in one place isn't sufficient evidence of global change. We have to see these trends at the global scale, and they have to be consistent with a warmer planet. And so the reason why this report is so important is because it pulls all those pieces together to show that changes in our rainfall extremes,
in our droughts and dry days, and in our heat waves and extreme heat, all of those three things are linked to global change.
Great. Okay. Well, we're obviously excited about the full report coming out. Okay, let me check first of all with Richmond. Ellie, does anybody in Richmond have a question that you wanted to ask Dr. Hayhoe?
Yeah, I kind of have a question. You know, a lot of times, so the list of things that you said for saying is to talk about our faith and the fact that God created the universe and we're stewards of the planet and to love our neighbors as ourselves. Sometimes when I read a report on climate change, certainly all of those values I share. And then I think, oh my gosh, what about my little family and my little life is going to be so changed. I look at my kids and there's so many thoughts that go through my heart at that time. And I'm wondering, I mean, that's the scarier conversation to have with oneself or with others. And I'm just wondering what's the framework for that. For your opinion.
I'm glad you said that because I feel like that is another important aspect of this is to focus on how it's not just this global problem that affects the polar bear that you know many of us have never even seen in their natural habitat. It's an issue that's affecting us right here in the places where we live. And if we can pull in some examples of what's happening in the places where we live to show people, I think it really brings it home. And then what you just said about connecting on our common values. I mean, what more common value do we have than our love for our families? And so if someone else was talking to you who you felt was from a radically different background and you didn't understand them at all, but if you realized that the reason why they were talking to you is because they were concerned about the safety and welfare of their family and their children, well, immediately you can identify with them because that's what you care about too. So I think that's a huge part of it is bringing in the things that we love and care about because those are things that all of us as humans share.
Great. Good question, Ellie. Thank you for that. Danny and La Jolla, is there anything that you or someone from your group would like to ask?
Yes, I have a question. So legislative aides have an attention span of about one page, and so I'm wondering if you know of any documents that have, in just one page, kind of summarized the official positions of the majority of Congress. We have the report that came out of the Catholic Church that acknowledges the climate is changing, man is causing it. It's a problem we're spending money on, and we should be, at the same time, mitigating things we can't affect. So I'm wondering if you know of any good summaries that cover the major religions in the United States in one page.
Oh, that's a good question. I have a feeling like I've seen some websites that do that, but I don't know offhand what they are. I will need to find out. I'll find out, and I will email Mark if I can. But I feel like I've seen that before. And it's very useful because you never know who you're going to be talking to. And I know that, obviously, Buddhism has some some really good things to say about protecting the planet. I know that the Jewish faith does as well. And all of the different types of Christian faith do. They have statements by the Catholic bishops, by the Pope, by the Anglican Church, by the Episcopal Church, by the Convention of Southern Baptists. Actually has a statement out. There's a statement signed by major evangelical Christian leaders in 2006. So there are a lot of statements like that, and I'm sure somebody must have collected them. I think that's a great resource to have.
Yeah, and just FYI, Cheryl, the leader of our group in Toronto, began that process also on her own and then handed it off to one of the interns in northern San Diego. So we are compiling a pretty broad list. We'll try and distill it down to something meaningful that people can have, but we have collected quite a few statements from quite a few organizations. Good question, Danny. All right, Brett and Bemidji, does anybody up there have way up in the almost the top of Minnesota have a question?
You know, Mark, I think we're actually good today. This has just been a really informative dialogue.
Okay, fantastic. Thank you, and it's so great to have your chapter aboard. Welcome to all of you, and it was just a real privilege to be up there a few weeks ago.
Woo-hoo!
All right, Sonny, how about St. Petersburg? Does anybody have a question down there?
We were just discussing how a lot of these issues are the same issues we're facing when we're talking to our friends and our family, our conservative friends, and very conservative and socially conservative, sometimes very religious families. So I'm going to pass this on to Aaron, who had a scientific question.
Okay, good. And then just right after Aaron, we'll go up to Sudbury and then to North San Diego. So go ahead, Aaron.
Yeah, you said that without human disturbance that the Earth would be cooling because the sun is dying, or what's the, and it also, does that mean that we need to be good sewers in the future and possibly keep the Earth at equilibrium at a certain temperature? Would that be most beneficial for everyone?
Good question. The sun is not dying over human life scales. You know, it's going to be millions of years before before the sun would get supernova. So we don't have to worry about that. But what we have is two things.
Okay.
We have natural variations in the energy of the sun that are chaotic. You can't predict them. And so sometimes we get a little bit more energy from the sun, and sometimes we get a little bit less just because of natural variability in the sun's output. We can track how much energy we get from the sun. We can actually measure it. And over the last 40 years, we have been getting less and less energy from the sun. We don't expect this to continue. I think it will go up after a little while. But the point there is that if our climate were being controlled by the sun, then we would be getting cooler. You can't have a system where it's getting less energy into it and it gets warmer if there's nothing else going on. So that's the first point. The second point, though, is really interesting. If you think over the long term, if you look over the history of the Earth, we came out of an ice age about 18,000 years ago, and we've been in a warm interglacial period ever since then. And if you look at our temperatures over the last few thousands of years, our Earth's temperatures over the last few thousands of years have actually been gradually cooling until the Industrial Revolution. So there is a pretty solid hypothesis among geoscientists that the next thing coming down the pike in geologic time, you know, geologic time is, you know, thousands of years, the next thing coming in geologic time is another ice age, which would be very, very detrimental to human society and human welfare. So in that respect, I think one of the arguments that we might put forward, that's a very long-range argument, we don't really work very well with long-range arguments, but we might want to conserve our fossil fuel resources for when we really need them, because we might need them in another 1,000 or 2,000 years. We might need them to stave off another ice age at that time. And we'd be pretty sad if it turned out that we burned it all up and we didn't have anything left. So, you know, arguments that go out 2,000 years don't really appeal to people usually, but I think it's just an interesting point to make that in several thousands of years, we might look at another ice age. And we might, you know, climate change, we might even stave it off. I mean, the situation we're looking at now is so unusual. We have never seen anything like this in the history of the Earth, where humans have taken over the control of the planet. So really, you know, we could have, you know, our warming effects on this planet will continue for probably 5,000 to 10,000 years. That's how long we've perturbed the climate of the planet already. So I think we really just need to focus on what's going on in this 100 years, what's going to happen to our children, what's going to happen to our grandchildren.
Okay, well, let's make sure, because I do think that you're Canadian also, that we get a Canadian question. So, Sudbury, does anybody have a question up there?
Yes, Mark. One of our members up here belongs to a Christian denomination, and he has a question. He'll identify himself.
Sure.
Hi there. It's Steve May from Sudbury. I'm a member of the Lutheran Church of Canada. They're in fellowship with the Missouri Synod in the United States, so lots of common factors between the Lutheran Church in Canada and the Lutheran Church in the U.S. I've had some conversations with a number of pastors in my church community who have questioned climate change based on the IPCC science, and specifically the consensus-based decision-making approach that the IPCC utilizes. Their concerns are